This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. I use it with my patients at the Hoffman Center all the time. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, the company is offering you special savings of $50 and free shipping. To find out more, go to TryZonaNow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman to get your $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662 or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to do something a little different. We're going to do a potpourri of stories about health, stories that I think are of compelling interest, and we're going to get the word out to you. You know, sometimes on weekends, we endeavor to get as many stories out to you during our weekend program, but from time to time, we get a flurry of calls, and it crowds out some of the important stories that I think deserve your attention. So today we're going to deal with some of the stories that ended up on the cutting room floor. And the first story that I'd like to share with you has to do with a new book entitled ADHD Nation: Children, Doctors, Big Pharma, and the Making of an American Epidemic by Alan Schwartz. It's a new book just out. Schwartz is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. And this is a subject that is near and dear to me because I actually wrote a book on this that turns out to be a little prescient. It was written in the early 1990s, and it's called Natural Treatments for Attention Deficit Disorder. And at that point, I deplored the rise in prescriptions for kids and adolescents with so-called attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and I proposed natural approaches. And here it is, 25 years later, and it's only gotten much worse. It turns out that 15% of American school children are said to be sick enough that they require powerful medication just to get through the day. That's a pretty deplorable state of affairs. And this has incalculable effects on their long-term developing brains. It's really poorly understood what will happen when kids are showered with pills for years and sometimes decades and sometimes throughout their adulthood. Is it possible that it literally changes the way that their brains work, that it burns out brain circuits? What's going to happen when some of these kids reach an age where they no longer can take these pills that can speed up heart rate or raise blood pressure, and they'll have to go off? Will they be completely brain dead, unable to function entirely? So in this book, which is just out, and we're going to reach out to the author to see if we can interview him for one of our Intelligent Medicine podcasts in the future, there's some interesting history about how these drugs got initiated. It turns out that it's a little bit like the Viagra story. Viagra was originally not targeted for sexual function. Viagra was designed as a medication to improve circulation in the heart in patients with angina, circulatory problems. It was designed to dilate blood vessels in the heart. And so they did a little study, and they found that it didn't really work that well. So at the end of the study, they said, thank you very much to the study participants. Collect your study honoraria. Sometimes these research subjects are paid. And end of study, we'll let you know if the drug ever gets approved, but we kind of doubt it. And several of the male study participants said, hey, I wonder how we can get a hold of some of that stuff. And I said, why? Why should you be interested in getting a hold of that stuff? Doesn't seem to work very well for heart problems. And they said, well, you know, there's another realm of human performance where we seem to experience a boost. And lo and behold, they had improved sexual function, and the rest is history. They started studying Viagra and its ilk. It's something that works on nitric oxide metabolism that is vasodilating and doesn't do that much in the heart, but it does seem to do something for another part of the anatomy. So in a similar way, the use of these powerful amphetamines was pioneered in the 1930s. And how it came to happen, there's a little bit of history that I gleaned from a review in the New York Times of the new book, ADHD Nation. Charles Bradley, who was director of a home for, quote, troublesome children, had a problem because they used to do something that they have long since abandoned. They used to study the brains of kids, and this sounds very barbaric, by doing x-rays. They didn't have CAT scans. They didn't have MRIs. But they would inject air into the cerebrospinal fluid in the patient's skull. And this is a terrible, it's like a medical, some kind of relic of the barbaric past of medicine. But this created tremendous headaches, as one might expect, excruciating headaches that lasted for weeks. And Dr. Bradley was given samples of a medication called benzedrine sulfate. And he was a psychiatrist, so he got the samples. And he decided to give the kids the benzedrine sulfate, which is an amphetamine, to see if their headaches would go away. And, of course, it had no impact on their headaches whatsoever. But what it did have an effect on was their behavior. The drugs seemed to boost the children's eagerness to learn in the classroom and made them more amenable to following the rules. It calmed the children's mood swings and allowed them to become, in the words of their therapist, quote, more attentive and serious. And that was unexpected. But the fact that it seemed to work on behavior was buried for a couple of decades until the 1950s and 60s. Because at the time, it was thought that psychoanalysis was the right way to address these problems. And besides, Bradley was an inveterate opponent of the use of medication to control behavior. And if he were alive today, even though he was, in effect, the discoverer of ADD medications, he would be appalled at the fact that 15% of American schoolchildren require or are said to require these medications. So that's a little history on the origins of these medications. And so, a lot of discussion in this book about the fuzzy definition of ADD. You know, how do you know you have ADD? Well, you can get on the internet and you can fill out a self-questionnaire. And when it comes to kids, they say that the telltale signs of ADHD allegedly include kids who have trouble organizing tasks and activities, or who run about or climb in situations where it's not appropriate, or fidget with or taps hands or feet. And you can imagine, you can't find a kid who doesn't exhibit these behaviors at some point or another in their development. So pretty much it's a wide dragnet that brings people in increasing numbers. Now, Schwartz is not an inalterable opponent of medication for ADD or ADHD. He starts the book by saying, attention deficit hyperactivity is real. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. But he points out that this pervasive prescribing is the result of a concerted campaign which involves an unholy alliance between drug makers, academic psychiatrists, policy makers, and then they recruit celebrities to advocate the use of medications. You know, people who say, well, I have adult ADD, and these medications fix me all up. And here's a quote from the book, actually a quote from the review. By bankrolling studies, cultivating mutually beneficial relationships with psychopharmacologists at prestigious universities like Harvard, and laundering its marketing messages through trusted agencies like the World Health Organization, the pharmaceutical industry created what Schwartz aptly terms, and I'm quoting, a self-affirming circle of science, one that quashed all dissent. So, you know, it's sort of like a scientific vogue, but it's also in league with efforts by Big Pharma to promote ADD awareness. And then you have the pressure of academics, where parents really endeavor to get their kids put on these medications so that they can compete on an even playing field with their other classmates who are on these medications, who sit and study and can cram facts and focus better. And this is, you know, those of you who have kids, you know how pervasive this is. And some of you want to keep your kids off these medications. Well, they're actually at an unfair advantage to other kids who are taking speed. You know, it's a performance enhancer. Whatever the downsides are, you know, the problems that occurs in terms of side effects, there's no question that if you take speed, you're gonna focus better. So during an exam situation or, you know, cramming for during a course, you know, trying to get that A plus that's going to get you into the Ivies, these medications really deliver. And so there's tremendous pressure to take them. So in conclusion, this article, in this review in the Times says, ADHD Nation should be required reading for those who seek to understand how a field that once aimed to ameliorate the behavioral problems of children in a broad therapeutic context abdicated its mission to the stockholders of corporations like Shire and Lilly. Schwartz is sounding an alarm for a fire that looks nowhere near abating. You know, and again, I'm not saying there's no such thing as ADD and it needs to be treated with vitamins and supplements, and invariably diet prevails. But there is a huge perspective that we're missing out on when we don't address this condition naturally. And many kids can be spared a lifetime of dependency on these medications. Okay, this next item has to do with flaxseed. And flaxseed is one of my favorite treatments for women who have breast cancer and men who have prostate cancer. There's an article in the Journal of Medicinal Food. The headline is, flaxseed-derived enterolactone is inversely associated with tumor cell proliferation in men with localized prostate cancer. The major source of lignans, that's spelled L-I-G-N-A-N-S, there's two major sources, flaxseed and sesame seeds, period. There's some in whole wheat, wheat germ, there's a little in kale and broccoli and apricots, but the major sources are in particular flaxseed and to some extent sesame seed. And these lignans have interesting effects. There's actually some discussion about flax lignans for cardiovascular disease prevention. And I'm reading from a review article. It says, there's intriguing but not yet compelling evidence from epidemiological studies that lignans present in the very small quantities typical of usual Western diets decrease coronary heart disease and cardiovascular disease death. More research is necessary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in that article, they review evidence from studies that suggest that consumption of lignans can reduce arterial stiffness, which is a sign of cardiovascular disease and is associated with hypertension. It's a risk factor for heart attacks and strokes. There is some cardiovascular benefits, but what's particularly intriguing is the impact on cancer. And there's no question that there's a relationship between prostate cancer in men and breast cancer in women. The tissue seems to be similar. And these are both hormonal cancers. They're both treated with hormonal blockade at certain stages. So there's something going on there with hormones. And it turns out that in this study, they examined the association between enterolactones from flaxseed with several markers of tumor proliferation, or growth. So these are NF-kappa B, something called VEGF, which is vascular endothelial growth factor. You can imagine that you don't want more growth factor in your cancer. So VEGF is actually a target for many cancer drugs. If you can get VEGF down, the cancer will grow less quickly because it'll be deprived of its blood supply. And then there's something called Ki-67, which is also a marker of proliferation in prostate cancer and breast cancer. So they looked at 147 patients with prostate cancer, and they got flaxseed supplementation. That's 30 grams per day. 30 grams per day, what does that translate to? It's about 15 grams per tablespoon. And so they got 2 tablespoons of flaxseed. That's a reasonable amount for 30 days. And what they found is just in 30 days that there was a reduction in Ki-67, which is a marker of proliferation. There was also a reduction in VEGF, vascular endothelial growth factor, and NF-kappa B. And actually, I'm sorry, they did not see a big association with NF-kappa B. But 2 out of 3 were affected by the flaxseed. And therefore, you know, we have reason to believe that taking flaxseed or concentrates of lignin, you know, if you don't want to take flaxseed, you can take a product called Breveil. I prescribe this to men with prostate cancer and women with breast cancer. You can find it at drhoffman.com or on the internet. And, you can take, and if you can certainly do this preventively, nothing wrong with taking some flaxseed. Sometimes I'll sprinkle a little flaxseed over a salad. Or when I have fruit, I might sprinkle a little flaxseed over my fruit. So the best way to obtain flaxseed is get them in vacuum-sealed packs because it gets stale very easily. Keep it in the freezer or the refrigerator sealed up. And if you want to get whole flaxseed, get whole flaxseed that can be ground, grind it in a specific grinder. You can grind it in a blender. You can grind it in a coffee grounder. The same things that grind coffee beans are very suitable for grinding up a little bit of whole flax seeds. The problem with whole flax seeds, you really got to chew them up, so you actually want it ground to release the enterolactones specifically. Scientists in Finland recently tried to determine if probiotics given to pregnant women might reduce the chance that their babies would develop eczema. You know, there's been a lot of controversy about whether breastfeeding can reduce allergic problems, and some studies say yes and some studies say no. Not enough attention has been given to the microbiome of the mother. And that may have a profound impact on the children's microbiome. And we know that the immune system really is governed by what's happening in the gastrointestinal tract. So women were selected on the basis of them having allergies for this study, because this increases the chances that their babies might develop eczema. So they looked at several hundred women, this in Finland, half of whom were given a probiotic during their last 2 months of pregnancy, as well as during the first 2 months of breastfeeding. And the other group received a placebo. And the results were quite astonishing. The risk of developing eczema in the probiotic group was an astounding 70% lower than the placebo group. So the authors concluded, quote, maternal probiotic supplementation during the last 2 months of pregnancy and the first 2 months of breastfeeding significantly reduced the risk of developing eczema in high-risk infants in this study. Note that the probiotics were administered exclusively to the mothers, whereas the infants did not receive probiotics. Well, so they say, but the infants probably did receive probiotics because it's going to be invariably transferred from mom to the babies, especially via vaginal delivery, or just simply from the mother's skin surface during breastfeeding and contact. And then, you know, the kissing that occurs often, you know, transmits the mother's flora to the child. So what's also interesting is that conversely, What's the opposite of giving probiotics? The opposite of giving probiotics is taking antibiotics, right? Pro, anti. And studies have shown that if you give a child lots of antibiotics, their risk of allergies will increase. Moreover, another consequence of that is that the child's risk of obesity will increase. So it'd be interesting to see if there's also some correlation between probiotic administration and a child's risk of developing overweight. But kids with allergies, they're often candidates for being sick, and they certainly might require more antibiotics. You know, kids who have those ear infections all the time, they often get too many antibiotics. So there's a lot of benefit in taking probiotics during pregnancy. They did not specify here the type of probiotic that was given, but I suspect it was some sort of bifido and or lactobacillus combination. And speaking of the microbiome, here's an article entitled "Chronic Fatigue Syndrome is in Your Gut, Not Your Head." It's some fascinating research out of Cornell University where they actually managed to discern a specific microbial fingerprint for chronic fatigue syndrome. Now, this is exciting for a couple of reasons. Number one, it establishes there's a link, there's a gut brain link or a gut bodily link where something that's happening in the gut is associated with the chronic fatigue syndrome. We're not sure if it's simply correlation or if it's causation. It could be that chronic fatigue syndrome triggers problems in the gut. But conversely, it's probably more likely that imbalances in the intestinal flora trigger body-wide reactions, including reactions in the brain that cause debilitation. But the other reason that this is exciting is that remember, the headline is "Chronic Fatigue Syndrome is in Your Gut, Not Your Head." A lot of doctors are dismissive of chronic fatigue syndrome. They say that it's akin to depression. They urge patients, and it's not unwarranted to get, if you're suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome, to get some psychological help, because it is a devastating, debilitating condition. There's nothing wrong with that. But to prioritize that and say that it's just something where if you administer the right pharmaceutical cocktail and get patients out of their depressive funk, they're going to feel better. No, this is a real bona fide condition. The problem is there's no single blood test that indicates whether you have chronic fatigue syndrome. It used to be people said, oh, you have Epstein-Barr, but everybody tests positive for Epstein-Barr, so it's not a very good test for chronic fatigue syndrome. We lack effective tests that can objectify this condition and separate people who are suffering from fatigue from people who are suffering separate people suffering from depression from people suffering from chronic fatigue. But there's a hell of a lot more bodily symptoms, achiness. It's just not about being tired or demotivated or depressed in patients who have true chronic fatigue syndrome. Now, for the first time, this article says, Cornell University researchers report they've identified biological markers of the disease in gut bacteria. And they did a test called high-throughput analysis, which we're just beginning to develop for patients not in special study situations. These tests are just beginning to be commercially available. The authors of the study say our detection of a biological abnormality provides further evidence against the ridiculous concept that the disease is psychological in origin. The researchers collaborated with Dr. Susan Levine, who's actually a very fine CFS specialist here in New York City, and they studied some of her patients, and they also discovered specific markers of inflammation in the blood, which they say is likely due to a leaky gut from intestinal problems that allow bacteria to enter the blood. So we're hot on the track of, looking for the cause or potential cure for chronic fatigue syndrome. But the research team in the future will look for evidence of viruses or fungi in the gut or the presence of certain bacteria that trigger an immune response that make you feel awful basically, you know, fatigue is an understatement. Awful is the word for how these people feel. Certainly tiredness is an aspect of this, but they just feel sick. And it's possible that the presence of certain bacteria, or viruses or fungi, create endotoxins which traverse the gut wall and permeate the cells and tissues and hit the brain and cause an inflammatory reaction, or some kind of toxic metabolic reaction, where the mitochondria in the cells, in the muscles don't work efficiently. Patients experience bodily aches and muscle weakness, but also disruptions in their brain activity, where brain fog and memory problems, inability to cope or function, are cardinal features of this. All right, so our listeners know that we divide these podcasts into two parts. We will continue if you join us in part two. We got more to talk about. We're doing a potpourri today of intelligent medicine stories, and we'll continue with you in just a moment.